When a man's work is full of life and in harmony with his environment, it becomes a work worth studying. Wabi al-Hariri Rifai. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate all the continued support and downloads and all that kind of stuff. July ended up still very high in terms of downloads. I think the last 3 months have been my three most downloaded, so I appreciate you all very, very much. We're at 160 subscribers on YouTube, and even RSS has upped its estimate for my regular listeners, which I still think it's underrating me, but it's going up. So I appreciate you all. I thank you all so much. Now, as you might be able to tell from the title of this week's episode, we're not really going to be moving along to the Levant like I thought we would. After last week's episode, I had this very nagging suspicion that I was forgetting something. And sure enough, Tuesday came around, I went back and looked at my notes, and I determined, oh yeah, there was this whole subject that I was going to include with Arabia that I needed to talk about. But before we get into that, I did have some feedback I wanted to go over on the last episode, a fair amount actually, but there's really a couple of things that I thought were particularly interesting that I wanted to go over on the show itself. And this was sent to me by a listener. They sent me a link to an article from Carter et al. Titled "A Comparative Geochemical Study of Bituminous Boat Remains from H3, As-Sabiha, Kuwait, and RJ2, Ras al-Jinz, Oman." This was a very interesting article, if a little technical, and it did a wonderful job of mapping where and when certain finds related to bitumen and reed boat construction could be found and how they compared to each other. Interestingly, I didn't know this, but the oldest evidence of bitumen used to seal reed boats comes from the As-Sabiha site in Kuwait, and that's dating somewhere between 5300 to 4900 BC, and the boat itself was made from all local materials. The material at Oman dates to a slightly later time period, somewhere between 4400 BC and 3500 BC. And it was made from materials further north in Mesopotamia, showing, again, early evidence of long-range travel between the two areas by boat. Before we continue with the new stuff, I did want to make sure I was clear on two items. First, I mentioned how important bitumen was for sealing boats and ships. It was extremely useful and important for that purpose, but it was also used for a variety of reasons much earlier. It was used as a glue or an adhesive for tools. It was also used as a mortar and sealant for construction in some places. In fact, the article that was brought to my attention even mentioned that the resin composition used at the earlier sites was almost identical in terms of makeup as the resin mixture used for construction. Because some people had theorized that they may have mixed in animal fat or fish oil or something like that into the mixtures used for boat sealant. But no, it was apparently virtually identical. So that was a very good piece of information to know going forward. So I do want to thank our listener for that. They wanted to remain nameless, so I'm going to not call them out, not use their email address. So I appreciate you so much for that article. It's very informative, and I learned something new, because I was under the impression, because I had read it in a lot of places, that the bitumen used for boats and things like that was a little bit different from what they used for construction. But no, apparently, at least from that one site, shows that they are virtually, well, a couple of sites, they're virtually identical. So yeah, thank you. And the second thing I wanted to kind of clean up is that while Central Arabia might not have had permanent settlements, eastern and southeast coasts of the peninsula see villages and probably a town or two. Dilmun, after all, will have to emerge very soon, either at the end of this season or at some point during the next one. And it wouldn't surprise me if the small village that will eventually become Dilmun may have already been found. Also, small permanent settlements are probably being set up in other areas on the fringes of the peninsula that I didn't cover. Some probably across from the Horn of Africa in the southwest, some in the northwest near Sinai and the Levantine coast, as well as along the western coast bordering the Red Sea, though we have less evidence of permanent sites in those areas at this same time period. But I wouldn't be surprised if more locations might be found later. But the ones that we do have are very small, very slight, and there is a debate on how big or how permanent these settlements actually are. But in terms of tool assemblage and all that, there's nothing that is radically different from the neighboring areas in the interior of the peninsula. Now, there were some other feedback I got as well. Some of it not quite as clear, but I did get maybe a source or two to look into for future episodes covering the area, so look forward to that. Now, with all of that out of the way, it's time to turn our attention to the one very important item I forgot to mention when talking about Arabia for this season. Now, the reason I forgot to include this is because of how I organize my show. I use a couple of different spreadsheets when I organize things, and I've got a couple of massive timelines marking major historical events or periods, and others focusing on specific regions and the events in those regions themselves. And when we get to specific societies, I'll have spreadsheets, again, focusing in even further. From those various spreadsheets, I pull notes I've made on the topics I mentioned, find the sources I used for the notes, reread them, double-check, see if new material has been published, etc. However, sometimes when I'm making notes, I will enter topics on a different spreadsheet. In this case, I made a note of this development on the Asia timeline for last season, so 8,000 to 6,000 BC. And though I felt like I was missing something last week, I didn't think to check the older timeline until I decided Tuesday morning to go back to season 3. And there I found a note concerning Mustatil, or Mustatilan, I guess, depending on the accent or the dialect of Arabic you're speaking. But, you know, it kind of works out because much how I went over kind of more firm, specific stuff when talking about Egypt, and then I went into more of their esoteric, mysterious kind of proto-religion stuff. In this case, I have something to go back to for this region, and I plan on doing something similar for this for other societies that are beginning to emerge this season as well, so it kind of fits in thematically. Now, Mustatil, or Mustatilan, again, depending on the exact pronunciation guide you're using, is the Arabic for rectangle. Why this name is used, we will discuss shortly. Now, while there is evidence of connection with Mesopotamia in the east, with pottery arriving and with contact with the Levant by way of tools and animal herds to the north and west, there is another potential form of exchange, and that is that of religious or cultural exchange. Or, of course, maybe there was no exchange, and this is a completely homegrown expression of religious or ceremonial devotion. It's impossible to do more than speculate, but starting around 6500 BC, Arabia's climate starts fluctuating wildly, and there are periods where Arabia's remaining grasslands were being rocked by worse and worse droughts. And at the same time, a large number of, well, around the same time, maybe a couple hundred years later, so maybe around 6,000 BC or 5,800 BC, give or take, you know, 100 years one way or the other, you begin to see a large number of rectangular, or close enough to rectangular, shaped structures being built by the inhabitants of the peninsula. The vast majority of these were concentrated in the northwest of the peninsula around Khaybar and Al-Ula, though there are some scattered in all directions, with one or two being even south of Medina, and even one to the northeast of Riyadh, closer to the coast than it is to Riyadh, believe it or not. So this map makes me glad that I didn't get to this topic last year, because the study that had all these mapped out was published in March of 2023, and I didn't have it on my note, which was from 2022 when I worked on the timeline, or that specific timeline for Asia. So I'm going to go ahead and cite my two sources I'm using for this, if you wanted to look them up and look at the map and that kind of stuff. But the first is a paper from Thomas et al. From April 30th, 2021, and it is entitled The Mustatiles, Cult and Monumentality in Neolithic Northwestern Arabia. And the second is from Kennedy et al., entitled Cult, Herding, and Pilgrimage in the Late Neolithic of Northwest Arabia, Excavations at a Mustatil East of Al-Ula. Now, there is some overlap in authorship in both of these papers. A couple of people worked on both articles, but then there are several people that were not in the other working on, well, the other one. Right now, the total number of these structures is over 1,600. And a large number of them have been known about for some time, but there were some that were discovered via satellite imaging, using drones and stuff like that, and like the ground-penetrating radar and things like that. A translation of a common description that the locals used to describe them was works of the old men. And that's something that was actually came from an article or an older work cited in, I think it was the 2021 article I mentioned, but that was a quote from the 20s that people who had been kind of scouting out the area for potential excavation sites, they had learned that translation from the locals, who are, of course, very familiar with the area and know quite a few of those structures. Now, the smallest of these are around 20 meters, which is around 65 feet long, while the longest are near 620 meters, which is about 2,035 feet long. What these were has been debated for a while. In older literature, you'll see the different terms used. But in 2020, the Royal Commission for Al-Ula decided that they would merely be called Mustatil for their shape, and to just stop confusion from spreading. And honestly, this was a very good idea. It's a simple name, and all the different terms you could see in other literature, you know, if you're not familiar with all these different theories, it would get very confusing. And it was when I was first reading about them. Now, in terms of the hypothesized uses, some thought that these were used to trap or pin in animal herds. Some thought that these were sites of worship. Others thought they were territorial markers. And still others thought they might have been tombs. The only one that I think has been completely discarded of those theories is the animal trap slash pin theory. Though I should point out that while it's possible they were used for territorial markers, their primary use was that of a ceremonial or religious gathering site, or, you know, a combination of ceremony and religion. Also, some human remains have been found in some of the Mustatil, but not at most of them, at least the ones that have been excavated. And I think they've only excavated around 45, like really dove into around 45. They've looked at more of them, but like in terms of actual like full studies, they've only done around 40 or so. But those sites that have had human remains inside them appear to have had the remains added at a later period compared to when the site was being used regularly. So people aren't being entombed here until either much later or after regular use of the site had declined significantly. And again, like there's a bunch of animal remains all throughout the site's use, but then the human remains, where they've shown up, only really show up towards the tail end of that, or way after the animal sacrifices have died off. And when the human remains are found, they're not in a central location. Typically, these people are being buried kind of off to the side, in like the corners. They're not in the primary focus of these structures. Now that brings me to how these places were laid out and built. All Muscatels have four features. There's an entrance to the base through thicker, shorter walls that lead into a courtyard closed in by thinner, mostly parallel walls. Some are a little skewed to the left or right, but you know, that's probably just because of, you know, the lack of sophisticated construction techniques. Though in some cases it may have just been easier to keep them level by bending them a little, instead of having to maybe build them over like small rocky outcroppings or things like that. And then at the opposite end of the base, there is what's called the head. Now, the head could be a full chamber, or it could just be kind of a crevasse or a niche in the thicker walls of the head that are parallel to those of the base. So the base and the head have these thicker, shorter walls. Now, in some places, the head was sometimes actually built so it was underneath rocky outcroppings or overhangs, or sometimes if there was maybe like the ground was unlevel, they would build the head kind of in the higher position, so it would be kind of like the Muscatel was kind of rising upwards. Now, some of the larger, more elaborate Muscatels have a few extra features like this. Earth and stone platforms toward the base, called eye-shaped platforms. There are also sometimes circular cells kind of attached to the wall at the base or near them, with these larger standing stones placed in the center of these cells. These stones are referred to as orthostats. And this is a large stone with a more or less slab-like shape. A boulder is not an orthostat, just it's kind of those long, thin ones. Something similar to what we talk at Göbekli Tepe, or maybe even Stonehenge is a famous example. And usually this term is used to mean a single prehistoric stone that is part of a larger construction. Sometimes these orthostats will be placed near the center or niche of the head. Also, these were not just solitary structures in a lot of cases. They were built fairly close to each other. And when they say fairly close, they mean with 500 meters or 1,640 feet. And there could be pairs of them, but in at least one instance, there were around 19 all kind of built within 500 meters of each other. Now, the walls are usually made from local sandstone. They typically, of course, found these larger sandstone like rocks or outcroppings, and then they would easily be able to chip off these larger flat flake-shaped stones and just stack them on top of one another. Though there are examples of them using larger, more rounded sandstones too, specifically, especially when you get to the thicker walls at the base or at the head. And whatever the exact dimensions of the stones they're using, the long walls are not that tall. They range between 0.3 and 0.5 meters, which is like between 11 and 19 inches. So the shorter walls are a lot taller, but I couldn't get definitive dimensions on those. It was mentioned that the profile of the head and the base would stand out along the horizon. You would be able to see them. And if you were looking directly ahead at them, you probably wouldn't be able to see what was behind them. But, you know, again, the short, long walls, the shorter long walls, you could just walk around to the side and see directly into this courtyard. Now, despite the short walls, the entrance was actually very narrow. So, you could easily step over these shorter walls, but the entrance at the base was always very narrow. So to enter the court from that direction would probably require you to be very slow and careful and deliberate. And in some cases, you might even need to get in low and crawl in. So these factors are a large part of the reason why they don't think large numbers of animals were kept inside like a pen or, that it was a trap. It'd be something that they would easily be able to escape from if they really, really wanted to. Now, many of the Muscatiles that have been excavated have had these entrances sealed up with large single stones or stuffed up with mini stones. It's thought that they might have been a sign of ritually closing the site. Because again, you could easily just jump or jump across the long walls, but they just close them off. This is maybe like the backfilling and burying the carved stones at Chatelhoyuk. Of course, that's speculation now. It's not 100% agreed on. There are some that think that it is accidental or something that happened over time. And then there are those that do say that they were deliberately filled in. But here in the Muscatiles case, this was a deliberate act. So to speculate more, we need to look at what has been found inside these Muscatiles. And the most popular theory is that the people using them had some type of cattle cult. This is due to the fact that bull skulls have been found in the head of the Muscatiles. In some cases, they were even buried underneath those singular orthostats at the niche or at the center of the head. Though other animals have been found in the area as well, so like in other parts of the head or in the courtyard. And the bones all have cut marks on them, and some have even been burned. So the idea that it's a cattle cult is somewhat debated. Of course, if there was one, it would be a question if it was a homegrown cult or if it was transmitted by a neighboring population. The two big cattle cults that we've talked about so far, or that are speculated to have existed, is the one at Chatelhoyuk and the one at Nabta Playa. Now, if the Arabian population were influenced by either of these locations, I don't think it was directly. They would have gotten it from or developed it based on what people neighboring those locations directly had learned about these cults. I personally think it was an endemic development, something they came up with on their own. Chatelhoyuk was, of course, a sedentary society and had other religious elements like an earth or fertility or a nature goddess of some kind. And no evidence of that exists in the Muscatiles, or at least not any overt evidence of something like that being worshipped in the area. As for Nabta Playa, I could see its cattle cult spreading either up from the Nile Valley or via the Red Sea, and of course they had their own Neolithic stone monuments as well. But Nabta Playa's buildings appear to correspond with more astrological events, mirroring certain constellations, maybe helping them keep track of passage of time. And they seem to be interring specific cattle in kind of these like kind of rough mud brick huts. So they're interring, they're burying these cattle. I can't remember off the top of my head if these cattle at Nabta Playa had ever been burnt or cooked or even if they had actually been slaughtered or if they were cut. Maybe they were killed in other ways. Maybe they died naturally. I can't remember for sure. Whereas here, or in Arabia, at least again at the ones that have been excavated, there isn't really evidence of the cattle being sacrificed specifically to draw out kind of like a sympathetic cattle spirit or you know, as a form of protection. At least, obviously, there's no evidence of that. It's hard to get that just from bones. But rather, they lean to being more... so the ones here, I should say, I guess I'm trying to say that the cattle sacrifice here, they're more overt sacrifices or offerings. And again, that's speculation on my part, but that's kind of what my gut tells me kind of reviewing the two places. And again, we don't know for sure that the animal slaughter is the driving factor for constructing the Amusta teals. That could just be a byproduct of the site's actual use. Maybe there were initiation rituals of adulthood carried out here. These were meant to be sacred areas where bonds between extended families or tribes were renewed or established. And maybe the animals were merely killed as an element of communal feasting. Maybe this is where you all come together, like for some specific time period. So it's really impossible to say. This is all just speculation on my part. Personally, I think it's an endemic development, and the animal sacrifice is probably more just a byproduct of the community gathering together. And again, another thing that it might not be a cattle cult. There's a lot of different horned animals that are being sacrificed. It's not just bulls. It's goats, antelope, and specifically goats and antelope that are mostly male and mostly with larger than average horns. So, again, just take all that into consideration. That said, maybe constructing the Amusta teals were part of the establishment of bonds as well. And that leads me into, I guess, the final kind of element of these structures I want to talk about, and that is the estimates on how long it would take to build something like this. Now, keep in mind, these estimates were worked from a couple of different studies, and they are not one-to-one applicable with Arabia, because a lot of this was done looking at cultures like the Maya and other groups as well. But I think the Maya were like the primary focus of the studies that were done, or one of the two studies that were done. Anthropologists have kind of worked out, you know, mathematically, just kind of your average person, if they worked all day, they could conceivably move around 7,200 kilograms of cobbles over an 8-hour day. Now, that's around 15,900 pounds, which I know sounds like a lot, but again, you're not moving it all at once. Every so often, you're just moving like something that's maybe a pound or two. There are other estimates saying that if you wanted to, you could move stones maybe 50 meters from their source, and a person working 5 hours could move about 4,000 kilograms of stone in a 5-hour workday. And for 4,000 kilograms, that's around 8,900 pounds. All Amusta teal were made from readily available local stones. So that means a group of 10 people could build a Amusta teal that was over 150 meters in length over a 2 to 3 week period. The larger ones of up to 500 meters in length could have been constructed by a group of 50 people in around 2 months. Based on these estimates, it would appear that a small group could have built most of the Amusta teals in a very short period of time. And of course, for larger structures, a few hundred meters in length, construction would have taken a single family group around several months. But if multiple families or, you know, multiple tribes worked together, you know, you could have completed something like that in a much shorter time frame. So, just power of teamwork. Something to, you know, kind of keep in mind in terms of, like, how often you would have to construct with just 10 people. I would have figured, though, that most, like, family groups, like pastoralists like that, you're probably looking around at least 20 people plus your herds. And that's just, you know, people of working age. You may have older people, younger people too. And they could have helped in other ways, if not carrying heavy stones. They could have made sure people were watered, you know, prepared food, delivered things, that, you know, smaller items, things like that. But yeah, so that's it for Muscatiles. I am glad that I was able to kind of cover some type of religious or ceremonial aspect of Arabia. It's kind of hard to judge at this early date. We don't have any proto writings or things like that to kind of judge by. We know that the people living in Arabia will be heavily influenced in the east by the Mesopotamians, and in the west and southwest by groups living in Africa, Egypt especially, and of course from groups to the north in the Levant too, though these people were probably also being influenced by the Mesopotamians too, so that's something to bear in mind. But yeah, I think this is a good place. I got all the major highlights I wanted to talk about with the Muscatiles, I believe. I had thought maybe they would have been covered, like the shorter, like they may have put up like tinning over them or like animal hides or something like that. But apparently there's no evidence of that. There's no like post holes or anything that would have been useful to kind of cover the space. So that's something to keep in mind. At least, again, at all the sites that have been thoroughly excavated, which, you know, 40 of 1600, there's a lot to maybe come out and change. But we'll just have to wait and see on that. Yeah, so if you guys have any questions or comments or feedback, or if you have a theory about what the primary purpose of the Muscatiles were, please let me know. You can contact me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can comment on the YouTube upload. I do see those comments. I do try to reply as quickly as possible, though sometimes it may take me a little bit. And you can also direct message me via Twitter or X, or you can, you know, just at me there too and tweet at me, and I can respond in the thread that way. Whatever you guys would like. I look forward to hearing from you. I hope to get some more interesting articles or feedback. Anything that you would like to send, even if it's just a yo, what's up, please feel free to do so. I do stream on YouTube during the week. I will be streaming most of this week and weekend coming up, with the exception of Friday, possibly Tuesday as well. But I've got a couple of things going on. So if you see I'm live on YouTube, please feel free to drop in. Say hey, ask questions there too. But yeah. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope you have a good rest of your day and a good rest of your week. And have a good night. Goodbye.